This is Secret Skin, part of the Infinite Guest Network. Hi, my name is Michael Eagle. This is Secret Skin with your host, Michael Eagle. I also go by Open Mike Eagle. The show also goes by the Secret Radio Hour. Everything has two names. Thank you for being here. Hi, Michael Eagle here again. I am a child of underground hip-hop. I was steeped in that, my identity as a hip-hop consumer, and a lot of my identity as a rapper steeped in what is called underground hip-hop. As a niche, underground hip-hop is kind of defined by the delivery systems. It's defined by its distribution, or mostly lack thereof. The culture of underground hip-hop is one very much based on regional tastemakers. Say, for instance, you have a favorite radio show, a guy who works at the local college station. He might get one show a week, or there might be two underground hip-hop DJs that he might have a couple shows a week, a couple hours at a time. And during that time, that's when you as a listener, you as a consumer of underground hip-hop, a consumer of this niche part of the culture, are going to get your fix based on what they think is good to play. And usually it kind of covered a span of, I'd say, the last 6 to 8 years to that point worth of releases. So DJs would usually cover new releases and maybe things that have come out over the past few years up until that point. My main point of reference for this is when I grew up, when I was in high school, when I started dialing in to what underground hip-hop was. I used to listen to a station called WHPK in Chicago. I believe HPK stands for Hyde Park Kenwood. The station was the college station of the University of Chicago. And I would tune in every Wednesday night, every Friday night, and I would try to stay up every Saturday night for their show that started at midnight and I think ended at 2 in the morning. I think the Wednesday show, I believe, started at 9 p.m. and still goes on today. And the Friday show, I think, started around 9 or 10 and was on till midnight. There was a DJ named Icebox, a DJ named JP Chill, and a DJ named Eric. Eric was a Saturday guy. He also had a bunch of crazy names. I think he called himself like M Collapse R, some strange star system sounding DJ name. But this is how I would consume hip-hop culture. This is how songs came to me. I didn't have a bunch of other options. If you look to what were the major label or mainstream content distribution systems of the time, it would have been radio. It would have been music videos. And out of those formats, you would occasionally get some things that were underground, but for the most part, you were getting whatever was the hype thing of the day, whatever was in the middle of its major label album campaign. So to get the kind of regional flavor and off the radar stuff that I was really into stylistically and aesthetically, I mean, these things tended to be a little more genuine expression, a little bit more fun, and they weren't bound by any content restrictions. So the playing field in terms of the content and what was chosen tended to be very vast, and that was the kind of thing that was stimulating to me as a hip-hop listener. I would say the time range of what I would consider to be the golden age of hip-hop would be around 1991 to 96, I think, was the golden era for me. That was when most of my favorite releases were made. The things that came before that era of 1991, let's say pre-91. I mean, hip hop started in like the late 70s. So let's say everything from like, so let's say the late 70s, everything all the way up to like 88. The sounds and the systems and the machines they were using to put hip hop together at that time were very rudimentary. So by the time it got to 91 and 92, I'm not sure exactly what machines were being used, but there was an overall increase in the quality. I also think it had a lot to do with who artists were working with mix-wise. I think at the beginning or through that first early phase of hip-hop, a lot was going on in home studios, and even if it was at a professional studio, it was with engineers that might not have known how to maximize the sound quality of whatever the producers and the rappers were bringing in at the time. By the time it gets to 1991, 1992, more of the things that are happening that are touching me deeply as a listener and guiding my way forward as an artist today, I'd say albums or artists like A Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul and The Artifacts and Wu-Tang, and there's a lot. I could go on and on and on and on, and at some point I probably will. But the point that I'm trying to make right now is, if I'm a child of this era that I would say was between 91 and 96, I'd have to say that I'm an orphan of it now, because for the most part, it does not exist anymore. That might be kind of a cliche thing to hear from somebody who's been involved with a genre of any art form for a long time, in my case, almost 20 years now. You always get a lot of, oh, it ain't like it used to be. Oh, it was better back in the day before these kids got a hold of it. And definitely there's part of that in it. There's part of that bitterness. There's part of that Grandpa Simpson shake your fist at the sky that is infused into what I'm saying. But I also think that the disappearance of this genre is very unique. I think there's factors involved with it that I'm not sure have ever affected another genre of music before. There's two main reasons why. One of them, and this is the one that has affected the entire music industry, movie industry, periodicals industry, book industry, almost every mode of media consumption that there is of course downloading. The way that downloading affected this niche in a particularly interesting manner is that, like I said earlier, the culture of underground hip-hop was very regional. You would tape the radio in a lot of sense, or you would go to very regional record stores and buy local artists who were able to press up certain things on tape, certain things on vinyl, certain things on CD, and this was the majority of your collection and how you consumed the music. So trading, tape trading, taking your vinyl and putting it on tape and being able to send it to other people, making mixtapes out of the rarities in your collection, it was a big part of how our culture was spread from one township, one metropolitan center to the next. You had people from New York trading underground West Coast music, people from LA trading Seattle underground music, people from Chicago getting music from Cincinnati and Minneapolis. All of these things, or this sharing, the idea of having taken what you had and being able to put other people onto it, was such a huge part of how this culture was shared. Once downloading became an option, once there was a system by which you could look up somebody's entire file system, and with the click of a button, you could take it all and make it yours, underground hip-hop fans downloaded voraciously, viciously, hungrily. Just take. And I can say it because I was one of them. When Napster was introduced to my life, probably, 1999 or 2000, I would literally just be all day thinking of things that I could look for to download. All day. I'd be in classes, and in the margins I'm writing down names of acts or names of songs or whatever I could remember, because at that point it was basically, if you could spell it, you could have it, because somebody would have it. And this, you know, it's going through Napster, the other engines like Morpheus, Audio Galaxy, LimeWire, up until Kazaa, all of these with this basic, the basic way that these file sharing systems work is that you offer up a portion of your collection for perusal. In the meantime, you're looking for other people's to download. So our niche was one of the earliest pioneers of downloading. And like I said, we did it with an appetite that is just hard to describe how heavily we got into it. And so it cannibalized our niche pretty quickly. Because not only did our dollar, in a sense, stop going into that economy, we stopped paying for music because it was available for free in so many places. We're shrinking the economy because our dollar's no longer in it. We're not paying these artists for the music. And we are actively stealing the music. So we're reducing the worth of it in two ways. By not continuing to give money to the artists to allow them to have the budgets to pay, and then also to take the music and have the music, but without trading any money for it. So in that way, it's kind of twofold. And in that sense, so many regional record labels, that would be the only way that a lot of these regional local artists could afford to press up or could afford to market any music, a lot of those went away. I moved to LA in 2004, and by the time I got here, there were scores of labels who had helped some of the artists that I know who've been doing it a little bit longer. They had been the keystones in these guys' careers. And slowly but surely, as, you know, distributors stopped having money for them, they folded left and right. To where I'd say now, I know a lot of very, 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 very talented rappers and producers that 10 years ago would have had many options for label homes and now have none. And a big reason for that is the downloading that we engaged in. And remember, I said there's two main reasons. Two? Count them, two main reasons. As if the downloading wasn't enough. Something happened to the style of music made in this time that I really can't think has ever happened to any other genre that I'm aware of at all. At some point in the early 90s, it became illegal to make this style of music. Give you some background. Like I said earlier, hip-hop started in the late 70s. Originally, in dance clubs where DJs would play or say rhymes in between songs. And then in the parks of New York, where DJs would play records, sometimes two of the same record at one time, and loop back and forth on turntables. And they would get to the part of the record, and they would get to the part of the record, sometimes a part that didn't have vocals on it, maybe the instrumental change, usually after the second chorus. Sometimes it'd be called a bridge. They called it a break. They would play the break in the record. And since they had two records, one on each turntable, they'd play the break on one side, then switch over to the other turntable and play the break on the other side, rewind it, play the break on the other side, rewind it, play the break back on the first side, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth again, while the crossfading on the mixer, and it sounds like one continuous loop. This is called them playing the breaks of the record. When they started doing this, certain dancers would come out and kind of show new moves. They would thrill the crowd during that time, and those were called break dancers. And also, this is when the MCs, or masters of ceremony, they would go on top of these breaks where there usually weren't any words in the music that the DJs were playing, and they would say rhymes to entertain the crowd. So this is basically where hip-hop came from. And when it came time for hip-hop to start being made in a studio, it was using a lot of these same techniques and philosophies. So rappers and producers, they would bring in their favorite records. They would try to find the part that sounds good looped. And they would take it to the engineer and have them loop it. And they would record their rhymes over these loops. And that's how hip-hop music was born. In the 90s, there was this legal case where Bismarck E., who was a popular rapper at the time, he had a really huge hit with Just a Friend. He had sampled a song from an artist named Gilbert O'Sullivan called Alone Again Naturally. And he did a loop of Gilbert O'Sullivan's Alone Again, and he did these story raps about how he was left alone in certain places. This was a really, really cool song, but it ended up going to court. The owners of the Gilbert O'Sullivan Records sued Bismarck E. and the label that put it out, saying that it was an infringement on copyright, and they won. So the result of that court case was that you had to now get permission from any artist that you wanted to sample to use their works to make a hip-hop song, or any other kind of song for that matter, unless it was a parody. So that's how Weird Al is able to kind of get away with it, or not get away with it, it's how he's still able to do his thing this long, is that he's parodying songs, and then that falls under parody law, which is a whole other way of dealing with copyright. So at this point, if I want to bring in a David Bowie song, I'm like, oh man, this part would be really great to rap over. And I loop it up on my computer and I write a song to it and I want to publish it. I either have to go try to get permission from David Bowie if he owns the copyright to that song or whatever label does. And that can cost tens of thousands of dollars. Occasionally, an artist will be like, okay, and just grant permission. But there's so much money in the publishing that very rarely does an artist allow another artist to use their work for free. If I didn't want to try to clear it, there's another option that I have. I can just try to mask it in some way, try to sneak it out there anyway, and hope that since I don't sell a ton of records, maybe this will go under the radar and nobody will notice. Problem then is that you can get sued on the back end. You're opened up, you're exposed to all types of levels of litigation at that point because you have infringed on a copyright and you are selling it. You're making money off of it. So you can get hit with a cease and desist, which could stop your manufacturing, or you can get hit with punitive damages from infringing on somebody else's copyright. And it can get very expensive. So the climate that's created now is one where no labels really, big or small, want to take the chance of dealing with records or dealing with hip hop songs or dealing with any song. There's even been indie rock bands lately that have been sampling and felt the wrath of the copyright lawyers, who oftentimes work even independently of the artist that they're representing. A lot of times it's not the case where an artist is like, oh man, that's my song. There's just so much money in copyright litigation that there's lawyers who are just constantly looking for sampled material to try to sue. I've heard even now that there's software involved that embeds a musical piece of DNA. If somebody tries to sample it, that's always there and detectable by the software. I'm not sure if that's true. That could be some anti-sampling propaganda that's made its way to me like a fairy tale or a myth to keep me honest in my studio. But you never know. And it could cost a lot of money, and it has cost a lot of money. And the labels are scared to put this type of music out. The reality for me as a hip hop listener and a hip hop creator is that my favorite albums in the world could not be made today. Midnight Marauders by A Tribe Called Quest. There's a sample on almost every song, a major sample. The songs are constructed around samples. The De La Soul albums that I enjoy, Common Sense's Resurrection. These albums that have impacted me so largely as a youth, as a young adult, as a developing person, that taught me so much about even my own culture and gave me these kind of positive ideals to aspire to, could not be made today. Fortunately, a lot of producers these days are learning how to play instruments, learning how to use different types of electronic musicianship to be able to create hip-hop music. But there is something lost, I feel, in being able to take a song that you enjoy, loop it, add some drums, and rap to it. That's not to say that I think that it should be necessarily freely legal to do so. I do understand that an artist is going to want to grant permissions for their work to be used in certain ways. But for how that particular style of music affected me, it seems to be a very large void left in the wake of how things have changed legally. It's also created this climate where the biggest hip-hop singles have a very synthetic sound. That's not necessarily bad inherently. It just makes it to where a lot of the progress of the sound of hip-hop is so tied in to software, tied into synthesizers, that a lot of the music tends to sound alike. It sounds very, very, very much alike. I would say it sounds more alike now on a mainstream level than it ever has. And I think taking out the variance that sampling was able to give you has kind of affected that a lot. If you have a lot of money, if you're a major label, you can still do a lot of sampling. If you're an artist with major label backing, if your budget's deep enough, you can definitely do what they call clearing samples, which is taking them to the original copyright holder and seeing how much money it would be to use them. But that type of budgeting is really kind of reserved for the uppermost class, money-wise, budget-wise. Me being an independent artist and being mostly surrounded by them, it's not really an option that we have anymore. And so a lot of us are attempting to recreate the music that we loved as a youth, but with brand new restrictions. And these things have kind of led to a climate where the sound and the economy of the genre is vastly different. And these differences have had a profound effect on the career of this episode's guest, Blockhead. Blockhead's been a fan and a participant of underground rap as a thing even since the early 90s, and he's had to clear a pretty unique career path to accommodate how much things have changed. We actually caught up to him in this really huge, unique building on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. It's actually the basement of the building that he grew up in. It's a building that Blockhead's father bought when he was really young. We spoke in what used to be one of his father's work areas, in a basement surrounded by some of his dad's unsold sculptures. There's a secret radio hour, and this is it.
Just for those listening, we're here with Blockhead, and we're in an interesting place.
Yeah.
We met over at the West Village. We ate pizza and we ate big gay ice cream.
Gay ice cream. That's where I take all the dudes.
It was a fantastic day.
Yeah, so far.
And so I've come home with him.
Yeah.
But no, we're actually in the house you grew up in.
Yes. Yeah.
We're in the basement.
In the very basement. Yes.
And it looks crazy in here.
It is. It is.
You said this is where your dad used to do his art.
Upstairs is what the studio was.
Okay.
It was my dad's studio. Down here was really just storage, and now it's become kind of like a, I don't know, where people saw things.
apparently there has been and will be a lot of sawing.
Yeah, a lot of sawing. But it's also a lot of storage for my dad's art, because he has tons of sculptures and stuff that are still down here.
Yeah, he had a bunch. I saw a bunch.
Yeah. I'll show you the rest of the house later. You'll get a kick out of it, because it's a pretty crazy house.
Yeah.
Especially for a New York house.
Wow.
Like, my dad bought the building in, like, the late 50s.
Okay.
So, and it used to be a like a factory.
And so, what was this neighborhood like when you were growing up?
Oh, man.
This is, I literally grew up in this house.
Yeah, the neighborhood in the West Village was bohemian. It was very neighborhoody, as opposed to now where it doesn't really feel like that anymore.
Yeah, it feels very gentrified.
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, it was always like, you know, it was back then, you could actually have a little, like, cultural mix, you know? It was very... You know, it was not gentrified. It was not, everything wasn't super expensive.
Right.
You know, like, artists live here.
All right. Okay. So it wasn't as much of an ethnic change. It was more like,
well, that too.
Kind of.
That too. There used to be, it's funny, like, around the corner, there used to be, like, a weird, like, just buildings where we're like, oh, that entire building, Puerto Ricans live in that building.
Okay.
Or like, oh, that entire building, like, you know, like Slovakian people.
Okay.
You know,
wow.
It was really weird, like, things like that. So, and people who'd lived here since, like, the families lived here since the 30s and 40s and, like, kind of just kind of kept around and stuff.
Did you, like, have friends in a neighborhood when you grew up?
Yeah. I mean, I went to school, like, grade school, like, four blocks away from here.
Okay.
And I was really close to those, a lot of kids from there, but none of them lived, like, on my block. Like, I didn't, like, go out and, like, play stickball or anything. But, like, you know, I played, like, Little League three blocks over. It's like, everything was kind of contained in this neighborhood.
So, yeah, like, a lot of friends in many different ethnicities?
I mean, mostly,
like, what was that school like?
The school was, I went to a school called VCS, which is called Central Village Community School. And it was basically, like, a hippie school where you call teachers by their first name.
Oh, wow.
And like, there's, like, 12 kids in a class. And it was a lot of art kids.
Okay.
Like, basically, like, it was everyone's parents seemed to be in some sort of...
And this is an elementary school?
This is, like, first through eighth grade.
Wow.
And, you know, it was mostly white, but there's, like, you know, sprinkling of everything in there, you know?
So where did the kids who were in the neighborhood, the ethnic kids, if they didn't go to that school, where did they go?
Oh, they went to probably PS3 is literally across the street from here.
Okay.
PS4. There's schools all over the place.
Okay.
I just... My parents were just like, we want you to go to an art school.
How did you like art school?
Or an artsy school. Not
artsy.
Art school.
Right, of course.
Yeah, not to be confused.
They weren't getting degrees.
No,
in third grade.
And I definitely didn't pick up any of the arts skills. I guess I like it, you know? It was cool. Like, I don't really... I have nothing to compare it to. Like, compared to high school, was way better. Like, I went to, like, a pretty more typical high school, and, like, that was not fun.
Was that your choice to go to a more regular kind of high school?
There weren't... Well, the thing about art schools and... Or, like, artsy schools, is like, in New York, is, like, it's kind of few and far between. Like you have LaGuardia, which is where, like, the dancers and actors go.
Yeah.
Or painters and all that. Like any sort of arts. And if you actually do art, then that's where you go. And I didn't do any of that shit, so I couldn't go there. Then you have a school... There's, like, the private schools that are kind of more liberal schools that I kind of wish I'd gone to one of those.
Mm.
It's funny, like, when I talk to people about going to... Because I went to private school on the Upper West Side. When I talk to people about that who aren't from New York, they're like, private school? I'm like, yeah. But you gotta understand, in the 90s, in 1990 in New York, there was literally five schools that were public schools, maybe five or six schools that weren't, like, a terror.
And just, like, absolute nightmare.
Like, you can't even, like, I remember there were schools you couldn't even walk by.
Yeah.
Like, there was a school across the street from my high school called Julia Richmond, and they, like, literally... would just attack my kid people. And it was a different time, you know?
Yeah.
And all those, the good public schools that you had to get into, you had to be accepted into.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to be kind of smart, good at math,
right.
Good at something. And I was none of those. So I went to a shitty private school. By shitty, I mean like not a school you don't learn well.
Okay. I can dig it.
And so, and that was that. And so compared to that, I enjoyed my first or eighth grade experience. Great.
And you went to college, yeah?
I did 1 year at Boston University.
Okay.
And I met Aesop there.
Oh.
And I dropped out. That's kind of fortuitous.
Wow. So Aesop, just for those listening at home, is Aesop Rock, who... You guys... I don't know if either of you started making music before the other. Did you guys start together?
We both started before we met each other. Okay. I was rapping when I met Aesop.
Okay.
Yeah. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
You did not know? Oh, I got to send you some demos.
Man.
You'll get a kick out of my punchline rap styles.
Now, what year was this?
I started writing raps probably in, like, 1990.
Okay.
So I was, like, 13, maybe, something like that. And then I kept going, and then I met this dude... who he worked at this toy store.
Mm-hmm.
This could have sounded really weird. And like I guess I'd known him growing up because I was like into G.I. Joes and stuff like that. And I used to go in there after school and just kind of shoot the breeze with him. And he was a rapper. He was maybe like 5-6 years older than me. And I'd show him my raps and stuff, and he'd be like, oh. And I'd kind of ghostwrite for him.
Okay. He was a rapper.
But I had, like, punchlines. You know, I definitely couldn't flow. I couldn't, like, everything about my rapping was terrible.
Oh, boy. I mean, everybody when it starts.
Oh, yeah, no, especially then. It was really bad. So I ghostwrote for that guy, and around 92, I think, maybe 92, 93, I started kind of getting to the idea of making beats, and I met this dude, Chasm,
okay.
Who was down with the Adams family.
Okay.
He grew up like 3 blocks away from here. He had a sampler. I would take samples to his house. And
what kind of sampler was it?
He had a MPC.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he
so this is what, 92?
93.
So was it just like the what MPC? Was that the first MPC around?
It must have been. It was to me it looked like a spaceship.
Right.
but it was, I don't remember what it was, but it was definitely like a, you know, pretty advanced machine.
What were you listening to then? Like 90 to 92? Like, what were you listening to?
The most obnoxious, purist rap guy on the planet.
What was there other than Purity the Beat?
So what I'm saying. Like, I would, you know, like, you know, like cursing like Vanilla Ice and cursing.
Oh, right,
like,
right.
Yeah, like all that, like PM Dawn.
Hammer.
Yeah, gas face. No. Yeah, exactly. Like, I was definitely riding for. But I wouldn't even, like, you know, like Pop Goes the Weasel. I was like, nah. Not
hard enough?
No, I just didn't like that. I was like, you can't sample Sledgehammer.
Okay.
Which is funny back then. I was like, you can't sample. Like, I didn't, you know what? I never liked Slow Down by Brand Nubian.
Oh, because it samples.
Because I'm like, it samples Edie Brickell.
Edie Brickell, yeah.
And I was like, you can't sample something that just came out. That's cheating.
I used to wonder about that song specifically because I think I'd heard Brand Nubian's first.
Oh, really?
And then I had that little thing where I didn't know. Obviously, hers was first, and it's just like, you know, they weren't sampling for her.
But it came out like 3 years before.
Yeah. But I mean, I think just exposure wise, I was, but like, I always wondered about that. Like, it seems like that would cost an astronomical amount of money to clear a sample of something that just happened.
I got to think they were probably under the same label or the same publishing.
So it had to have been something that...
Or they just gave her the entire publishing of that song.
Okay.
Or they cut a deal. Because that was the era when you didn't really clear samples a lot. I mean, people got, De La's albums had like thousands of samples on them. They didn't... That's why you can't buy them anymore.
Right.
But I gotta think they cleared it with someone. But I was listening to, a lot of stuff. I was listening to, East Coast stuff. I'm a New York guy.
But like, who did you think were your, in 1990, who was like your favorite rappers to listen to?
1990, I was probably, I'm trying to think. I mean, the Big Daddy Kane, Kool G Rap, like the basics of, the pillars of, mm-hmm. of rap were the ones that I definitely liked. But I liked even like Positive K a lot.
Mm.
I loved the Jungle Brothers. Done by the Force of Nature remains one of my favorite albums of all time. But I also loved N.W.A. Like, I loved the Ghetto Boys. Like, I remember getting those albums and just like feeling a rush. Being like,
yeah.
Whoa,
yeah.
That's crazy. Like,
dangerous, chaotic energy from other parts of
violence.
The country.
Yeah, like, yeah. Really angry. But compared to, like, I remember a friend of mine, I guess it was like 89 or 90, and a friend of mine was like, and I was like, I was really into Two Live Crew. Because I was, 14.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And a friend of mine was like, oh, you like Dirty Rap? I was like, yeah, yeah. He's like, you should check out the Jungle Brothers.
What?
Yeah. And I was like, oh, okay.
They have like Jim Browski.
They never cursed
right.
on a song ever.
Everything was like innuendo at best.
Innuendo and mostly like Afrocentricity. And
right.
It was positivity. So I bought this Straight Out the Jungle album being like, oh yeah, this is gonna be this like this crazy dirty album. And I'm listening to it, and I was like, this isn't dirty.
Yeah.
And I was just, what? And Jim Browski comes on, and I'm like, kind of. I mean, I'm listening to Two Live Crew, like the most horrific.
Yeah.
Dick Almighty by Two Live Crew. It's like a game changer.
I mean, like those dudes would like halfway giggle while they were rapping.
Yeah.
Because of things they were saying so ridiculously, like, and juvenile, I guess, it was like bathroom humor.
It was. It's kind of like. They said stuff then that didn't dawn on how stupid it was.
Right.
Like later, I mean, I don't know if this is appropriate for the podcast, but
it should be fine.
There's a line that Fresh Kid Ice says in a song called Dick Almighty, where he's talking about his dick, and he says, it's 15 inches long, 8 inches thick. And I remember being like, what? And just being like, really? And then I got older, I was like, no way. I mean, I know you're even through like hyperbole. Is
right,
that's crazy.
No, that's like that. You need to go to the doctor.
That's like three stacked up like iced coffee cups.
Yeah, that's like some Pringles can size that doesn't even exist.
8 inches thick.
Oh,
I was like, all right. But as a young person, I was like, that fucked my head. But so I got the Jungle Brothers and I listened to it and I was like, this isn't dirty. But then I just found myself going back to it, and all of a sudden I was like, oh. I like this, and then that opened the door.
And you were living here then?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
I would go to the Discorama, which is a couple blocks away, buy cassettes every week, and just
Did you ever listen to rap music down here in this basement?
Yes. There used to be a ping pong table down here that my dad made. He made it himself.
It was like dimensionally right.
Yeah. It was dope. It was like real good wood. And we would
paint lines on it.
Yeah. It was official. He did it just to be like get out of my hair. Go downstairs. So when
I will build you a distraction.
Yeah, exactly. And it was like literally in the basement of the building where no one could be heard and no problems would ever come up. So my friends and I would come down here in high school and bring like a stereo down here, like a boombox, and drink 40s and play ping pong. That's pretty much the.
Did you ever have any parties down here?
Not here. When my mom's house, after she used to go away for the summers, and then I definitely took advantage of that.
Yeah,
like it was like every weekend. nothing too dangerous, but
anything crazy you ever remember happening down here?
In this basement?
Yeah.
Not really. This is a pretty tame place.
It seems like it. It seems almost untouched.
Well, it's definitely dusty, like something that's never been touched before.
Yeah.
I feel dirty.
It's definitely a little thick.
It wasn't always. Yeah, it's probably not the healthiest breathing space.
So that other room is got, I want to say, what, 25 statues your dad made. How long have those been sitting there, you think?
They've probably been there for 15 years, maybe.
That's amazing.
I mean, you know, they've moved around.
So, under what circumstances do they get moved?
If they find a gallery,
okay.
If someone buys them,
How do people know they exist?
He's got a website. Like a portfolio online. I mean, it's the kind of thing. Like, I don't see anyone just being like, I need a sculpture. I'm gonna go online and find a sculpture and find this random website where this stuff's done. I mean, at this point, it's just like it's really the family will kind of inherit all of them.
Right.
Like, I don't have room in my apartment to put a bunch of sculptures in. So
you got brothers and sisters?
Mm-hmm.
How many?
I'm the youngest of seven.
Really?
But hear me out. There's five that are from my dad's first marriage.
I see.
Who are way older. I've got a niece who's 34.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of like this. But I have one brother who's from my parents.
Okay.
My dad's first marriage was five.
So there is a lot of people to inherit.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of us. I'm cool. I'm like, hey, we got no room.
How old are you?
I'm 37.
Okay.
I'm 38.
I'm 33.
Yeah. Young man.
You are. Exactly. It's all relative in this hip hop age.
Old rappers.
You don't have a family yet, right?
No, I have a girlfriend,
right?
No kids. No,
do you want to do all that?
You know, it's a topic of discussion.
Yeah, no, I bet.
I'm kind of one of these people that, like, I'm not crazy about the concept of marriage as a thing. I feel like a lot of guys say that, and it's kind of the easy way out to say it.
But it's probably the truth.
But I legit don't care. Yeah. Like, I would rather have a kid than be married, and I honestly am not like really gunning to have a kid. I wouldn't be like, no,
right?
But I don't know, it hasn't hit me yet. I still feel like a little too selfish and a little too.
Do you still have adventures that you want to have?
I'm a social person. I like going out, I like the ability to do things when I want to do them, and I know that having a kid will just eradicate any possibility
at least for 2 years.
You're a father,
and he's a 5-year-old. And now it's not so much that I can't do things, but it's like you have a visceral feeling of missing a human.
That's something I can't even fathom.
It sucks. You know what I mean? It really sucks. Like, I get in some head spaces where, like, I'll see another child and get angry. You know what I mean? Somebody else's child. I'm like, ugh, I don't see the kids.
Yeah, I'm like, you know that with, mean? With hot girls on the street. I see them, I'm like, God damn it. I'm wiped up. I'm just like, ugh. Especially now the summer's here. It's like a war.
You know what?
It's a war zone outside.
It is really interesting out there. You can tell, like, people have been waiting.
Oh, especially in New York.
To be free.
I mean, you're out in LA, so it's kind of nice all the time. But
right.
After the hell winter we had, the first, it hit like 55, girls were wearing blouses. I don't know. Okay. And now it's like 80, 90 degrees outside. It's just like shorts.
And everyone's getting sun.
A lot of sun. But yeah, it makes me want to just lock myself in a room and never go.
I hear that. Now let's go back to Boston College.
University?
I'm sorry. Boston University.
How dare,
because that is two different places. And I should be shocked for that. But so you meet Aesop.
Yes.
How?
Oh,
actually,
I think we left off the point.
Right.
Okay, all right. So I was rapping, and I eventually joined a group, or started a group with a couple of my friends called The Overground.
Okay, nice.
Which is me and three of my friends, and I'm still friends with all these guys.
Oh, that's nice.
I mean, two of them are like my closest friends.
Do they still do anything?
One of them is a producer. One of them goes under the name Sir Jarlsberg.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with that at all.
No.
Definitely something to look up.
Sir Jarlsberg.
It's a comedy. He was in Party for an Action Committee with me, which is a comedy rap group I was in the Def Jux era. And he pretty much does like medieval rap
and medieval
songs. Rap. It's really crazy. That's the best way I can put it. It's really crazy. But you should look that up. And another one is now does film work stuff. But we were all in a group, and we were kind of like fashioned ourselves as like the downtown Manhattan, like white Far Side.
Interesting.
Without the skills.
Were there dreadlocks involved?
No. We weren't like the white black teenagers.
Yeah.
No, but because we're like silly guys that did like punchline rap and kind of had terrible voices and couldn't. I mean, not that Far Side had terrible voices, but you know.
But they were like part wacky kind of zany kind of voices.
Not zany. You know, like all of us had our different personalities. Like I definitely was like took it the most seriously.
Okay.
I was like the rap. I was
You were like the lead rapper of the group.
I wasn't the lead rapper, but I was the guy that like I would write the most serious stuff, you know. Other guys would be like, one guy rapped about girls all the time, one guy just did battle raps, the other guy did kind of like flowy stuff. But so we kind of sucked. But then I went to college, And I met Aesop probably in the last semester there. Uh-huh. And we immediately bonded on some rap nerd shit. Like, we were just like, oh, you like this? And we, like, traded tapes and stuff.
Yeah.
And then I found out...
What were on the tapes
You know what's on the tapes? I had a friend at Capitol Records back then. I don't know how I knew anyone back then. But and he gave me the All Balls Don't Bounce album.
AC Alone's album, All Balls Don't Bounce. That's his major... His Capitol debut.
His Capitol debut, exactly. I had a shirt. I even had an AC Alone that had a check on it.
Yeah.
It was really good.
Oh, for like mic check?
Yeah, if it wasn't for a mic check, I wouldn't have a check on it.
Yeah.
So he gave me that album. This is an example of stuff that I had, but it was it came out probably a year after that, so I would give that. I had like Company Flow, all of the Stretch Armstrong.
Let me ask you this, because I've heard stories about that All Balls Don't Bounce album changing drastically from some early copies of it.
It had guidelines on it, and that's the only difference.
Okay, okay. Because I remember that is one thing people being kind of upset that Guidelines wasn't on there.
Guidelines was the best song on that album.
Interesting. Do you know Ace?
I have met him in passing once.
Okay.
Actually, the one time I did meet him was before I was doing music. He came to do a show here at SOB's, and he's opening for Spearhead.
Wow.
So, but my friend, I didn't give a shit about Spearhead, so I went with my friends to see. We had the album. The album was not out yet. He was just doing a show. Us three in the front row, the only people that care that he's there. You know, New York crowd's the worst. And literally, he's doing a song, and we're like, do Hallelujah!
That's so
And he was
tight.
Like, what? It's like, literally, the album wasn't out yet.
That's amazing.
And after the show... Like, we came up like, hey, man, big fans. And, like, he's like, yeah, hey, how do you know that? I was like, oh, I got a friend at Capitol. Don't worry, I'm not trading it with anyone. I haven't spread it around.
He was cool about it.
He was cool. But it was definitely, he was like, who are these three, like, teenagers that have my album are asking me here?
That's funny, because I hear stories about when they used to go up to the Bay, and, like, him and Ab would be performing, and then there'd be kids asking them to do old, like, Project Bo. Good Life stuff, but it turned out that the people who were asking them were like the Living Legends guys before they started.
Well, I'm saying it takes a nerd to know that. You we all learn our own ways, you know. You gotta obsess over this shit to really make it official. But yeah, so I was trading stuff like that. A lot of Stretch Armstrong, Bobbito, demo stuff. Like,
so that's what you had, or that's what
he had? That's what I had. I had a lot more than he did because I was that guy that collected all this stuff.
Right.
And I would, you know, I'd stay up and tape radio shows. And I just knew, I was actually on the internet at that point, and I was trading tapes with people in different states.
You were on like bulletin boards or something?
I was on this thing called Rec Music Hip Hop.
Okay.
Which is,
how would you access it at that time? This was like before browsers and stuff, right?
No, it was 94. So there was the internet. It's just, you know, type in a website and you go there. It was a news group on Google.
Okay.
But I met all these people who were just in the same kind of like, you know, fanatical hip hop people as me. And we traded tapes. Like I would have, like I had stuff from just people that like soul demos.
Yeah.
Like his name wasn't Soul.
So it's like 94.
Yeah, like stuff. And I would trade, like, I would like try to always throw some of my stuff in there just to be like, here, check this out. And then I never heard anything back about that. but yeah, I had any Freestyle Fellowship really had stuff, any West, like a lot of West Coast stuff. And I was like a East Coast guy that loved weird West Coast stuff.
But now, were there a lot of people like you here? Because I feel like there's always been a big separation between those two.
Not at all. Not at all. Like my friends were. Like we loved Soul Sides and we loved Project Load. We just liked anyone who rapped strangely. You know?
Right.
Like I had bus driver demos back then.
So you appreciated the different styles more.
Oh yeah. And you know, this like it was a purist of a really obnoxious kind of purist where I would be like listening to like Capone and Noriega, be like, nah, that's no real hip hop. This is real hip hop. And then, like, years later, I'm like, oh, that's kind of good. I kind of missed the boat on that one.
I hear that.
You know?
So, y'all are tape trading.
So we're tape trading. I really, you know, just hanging out. And I remember the first time I had never heard him rap before. Mm-hmm. We were at a party freestyling. Like, there was like a circle. And I was like mad shy about freestyling because I wasn't very good at it. And he comes in, and I was like, holy shit. Like, he was so much better than everyone.
What now? What year was this?
94.
Okay.
Maybe 95. At this point, it might have switched over.
So you've been, at this point, you've been rapping like 5 years?
I've been rapping, yeah, about 5 years.
And do you know how long he'd been rapping?
I'd say maybe around the same time.
Okay.
But, I mean, didn't matter. He was so much better than me. He rapped a lot like Saphir.
Okay.
That was the huge influence with him, you could tell. And So he just murdered this site.
Now, he was listening to a lot of Saphir, too, so he was into the West Coast stuff, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's another common thing. Yeah. Like, he was a huge Saphir fan. I had Saphir demos.
Right.
Like, Car Alarm and stuff like that. Like, all these... I haven't even heard them since that era, but they were really good songs. So he blew my mind in this freestyle because, like, you know, it seemed written. Like, he was so good.
Yeah,
that it seemed
like
written.
Flawless kind of styles.
And just saying, using words, I was like, how do you think of that word off the top of your head? Like, you know, it was an era where, like, Supernatural was the best freestyler.
But he was on a grid. Supernatural, yeah. Very, like, set up punchline.
And I can do this. And look at the fist. And it was very, like, you know, yeah. like you could see the setups happening where he was, like, sounding like a complicated written rhyme as a freestyle. So then he took me, I went to his dorm room one day and he had a 4-track. He's like, oh, check this out. And he played me a demo that was all voices. And it wasn't like some Bobby McFerrin shit, but it was just him layering his voice and it was all a cappella rapping. And it was crazy. And I remember being like, what is this? So, this is nuts.
Would it be comparable to like Leterix? Something like that? But when one person doing...
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I'm hazy on the actual details of it, but it wasn't like overlapping things going against each other like Leterix did.
Okay.
But it was just like this crazy original thing. I had never heard anything like it before.
Do you know if he still has it?
Definitely not. Like I have all the old demo stuff that we did together. I don't think he even. Every now and then I'll send him one and be like, huh? Yeah, like that stuff is long gone. But it was so then he came to New York for the summer. And I introduced him to my friends, and he would, like, freestyle with us, and we'd just be like, Jesus Christ,
yeah.
This guy is, like, so much better than we are. Like, it wasn't even, like, it would just not even be fun, because he's, like, a real rapper, and we're just, the guys are, like...
Hobbyists.
Yeah, we're hobbyists.
He's got that natural...
It was...
LeBron ability.
Yes, yeah, he was LeBron-like, and we were, like Damon Williams, or what's that guy? I forget. The guy who shot threes on the But yeah, he came in and then we immediately just tried to like, we're like, we gotta make songs. Okay.
And so you and him started recording at that point?
He did stuff on his own. He did stuff, this guy, Dove L, produced some stuff of his who did music for Earthworms, the majority of music for Earthworms. But then by that time I had a sampler.
Uh-huh. What sampler did you get?
ASR-10.
Okay.
Which is the same one. I have the exact same one.
The same
yeah.
exact model
yeah.
today?
Yeah.
And you still make beats off
of it? I've moved off it. As a primary thing, like
why have you moved away from it?
Cause it's just like it's really easier to use Ableton.
Right,
Ableton is just like it makes my job easier. And it
makes your workflow a little easier.
Oh yeah, I mean like, and but also just you know, for drums it's good, and for chopping things up, or just for like playing out chords and stuff. But everything else, it's like Ableton is just, I can make beats on the toilet, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, that's kind of...
Do you make a lot of beats on the toilet?
I don't. I have in my life. I don't make a lot of them, though. But by then, so I had my sampler, and we were both making beats, and he bought an ASR-10, and we're both, like, kind of learning at the same time, and we did beats for each other, and that was pretty much...
So, he made beats, and you rapped over them, and you made beats, and he rapped over them?
I don't think I ever rapped over an ASAP beat.
Okay.
But I definitely... He rapped over my beats.
Right.
But before he blew up and stuff like that.
So, this is 94, 95?
But by now, it's 96, 97.
Okay.
So, like, we've been hanging out. He moved to New York. He graduated from college, moved to New York.
And what's the first project you all made together?
Music for Earthworms.
But now you did.
I did one beat on Music for Earthworms. But I was the one man. I sold it online. In that news group. I literally was the only person. I was cutting out covers, sending them personally to people. Like
now these were CDs or tapes?
CDs. And there's literally, like there's a lot of, you on eBay, you'll see like Music for Earthworms original.
And that's something that you hand put together.
There's 100 of them on Earth.
You made all 100 of them?
There, we pressed them up ourselves. We burnt
you
them.
You only pressed 100?
We burnt them in a CD burner.
Yeah, I hear you.
One by one.
Yep.
And the only way you know they're real is if there's a sticker on this on the CDR. It's a CDR.
Yeah.
It's literally a CDR. And so there's 100 of those. So if you see that on eBay, don't buy it.
How quick did it take to sell out?
It was a slow burn because, you know, people are not... willing to give new stuff a chance, yeah. Especially back then where you couldn't like stream it,
right?
Just kind of be like, well, is it good?
Yeah, you'd see like some weird picture, and
yeah, exactly. Like, you'd have to go on my word being like, and I had like, you know, at that point in that news group, it was a pretty big news group, and I had like some cachet there, like people respected my opinion, and I would be like, it's really good, you should pizza. And then someone got it, like, oh, this is really good. And then it kind of ball got rolling from there. And then Hyro Emporium got word of it.
Now, Hyro Emporium, the website, or Hyro Emporium, the label?
Website. They had a message board.
Okay.
And this dude, Yamin, who I know, who ran it, was a big Aesop fan. And so he kind of put it over there, and the Living Legends board caught on to it. So basically, like, a lot of little things started picking up, and then...
People started spreading it around digitally, word of mouth.
Yeah, well, it was probably a lot of tape training.
But, I mean, the word of mouth was more on message boards.
Yeah. It was all internet. It was all internet. Like, in New York, he would do shows, and he wasn't a thing. Like, he was in that scene of, like... That bars scene, you know, like
was he called Aesop Rock then?
Mm-hmm.
And you were called Blockhead by this point?
Yeah.
So guess what, folks? We're actually going to stop right there. I'm going to pause it. Did you see how that conversation was going? All really good and stuff, and it was all informative and all stimulating to your brain. Guess what? Goes on for another hour that way. And rather than try to cram it all into this episode, split it in half right there. And in next episode, we're going to rejoin that conversation. He's going to begin to talk about him and Aesop Rock's work blowing up and how that transitioned into his solo career. It's all really good stuff with Mr. Blockhead. And that'll do it for this week's episode, this fortnight's episode. Thank you for listening to Secret Skin. And before I get out of here, as always, I'm going to play you guys a little bit of music of my own. I can't assume that all of you folks have heard my entire catalog. I've released 4 albums and numerous EPs. I got songs all over the place. And I figure it would be interesting this time if I played you a song that me and my guest actually made together. I have an EP called The Extended Nightmare Get Down. And on it is a track called Billy's Quagmire that is actually produced by Blockhead. It's our very first collaboration. So I'm going to play that, and we're going to get out of here on that note. This has been the Secret Skin Podcast, the Secret Radio Hour. This is produced by Platform Collection and part of the Infinite Guest Network. Thank you, folks. I'm Mike Eagle. Open Mike Eagle. Michael Eagle. Goodbye. Used to scratch palm to rep my crew. I used to think the Bulls would never lose. I used to wish that my fam had the revenue to buy a pair of Michael Jordan's patent leather shoes. Had weird gear but a road with it, and rock a Jabot shirt with a hole in it. All my damaged and used, it looked damaged or used. At its best it was a tad bit abused. I used to try to keep in touch with folks. If you know me, you know that that's a fucking joke. And a bad one at that. If I return half of my sack, I deserve a pat on the back. We used to try to have smart discussions back when we felt like we were part of something. And then we all went our separate ways once real life exposed the naivete. If you could travel back and set the record straight, time became unbound and you could separate. Would you rather have it now over yesterday? Would you rather have it now over yesterday? I put on a couple pounds like a heavyweight. I look down and frown at my resume. Would you rather have it now over yesterday? Would you rather have it now over yesterday? I used to go to Bloat on Thursdays and learn from rappers to emphasize wordplay. I spent a workday designing text surveys. 5 o'clock came and I run down the Murway to watch the homies play chess and the women dance. Like a pervert, but the girls didn't give a damn. An undergrad with cafeteria dinner plans. Bidding on spades, hope my partner's got a winning hand. And now we're running like children, and I'm hopping through time like I'm Billy Pilgrim. Secret Skin, also known as the Secret Radio Hour, is part of the Infinite Guest Network from American Public Media.